You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll look back at some of the top Wisconsin stories from the past year. First, Milwaukee's homicide total for the year is at 141, just shy of last year's official total of 145. Several people have been killed during the current holiday period. Chuck Kornbach has details on this year's homicides and what community leaders say is needed to bring the total down next year.
Perhaps Milwaukee's most high-profile killings took place in early March when a Hmong couple and a Puerto Rican man were shot to death at their apartment complex. It may have been a racially based hate crime. A few days later, Pao Vu, a relative of the deceased couple, Pia and Mai Vu, stood in a pouring rain and told mourners at a vigil that he felt sadness and anger.
Our anger rises to those who have brought down these feeling to us.
Also getting a lot of attention this year were the deaths of children. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's homicide tracker page, 7% of this year's homicide victims were under 18. One of them, 15-year-old African-American Melanie Johnson, died this month when her home was hit by gunfire. At a preliminary hearing this week for one of the alleged shooters, Milwaukee Police Department investigator Kyle Mrozinski testified about a medical examiner's autopsy of the teen.
He observed two bullet wounds to the victim, one to the left chest area and one to the left arm, and he ruled her death a homicide as a result of these gunshot wounds.
Melanie Johnson died just a few blocks from St. Gabriel Church of God in Christ. Minister Gregory Lewis is assistant pastor there. He's also president of Pastors United, a group of African-American clergy who've been trying to prevent homicides. Lewis says part of the ongoing problem is individual behavior.
I don't think that there's a lot of thought put into making things better for one another. There's a lot of disrespect and an uncaring attitude, and it's become stylish now to be disruptive.
But Pastor Lewis also says there are big picture concerns about drugs, guns, and lack of jobs, especially in some poor African-American neighborhoods. Police data show most Milwaukee homicide victims are African-American males aged 18 to 40, killed by gunfire. Lewis says if he could get Governor Scott Walker's attention, he'd ask Walker to add more funding for education and job training for Milwaukee in the upcoming state budget. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett says he'd like to see the governor and Republicans who control the legislature restore money cut from shared revenue over the last decade and put it into helping Milwaukee sustain its additional spending on police.
I have a lot of legislators, particularly from outside the city, who say, well, the city's got to do more about public safety. And my response is, look, we're putting $127 million more into our budget for police. The state's putting $12 million less in for the needs of the community. And you're talking to me?
Barrett says he can't guarantee Milwaukee homicides would go down, but says many experts believe a stronger police presence would make a difference. While there's more budget talk ahead, Pastor Lewis is getting St. Gabriel's ready for a solemn event tonight.
This is our sanctuary. That's where we deliver our message.
Lewis shows where the church will hold an annual reading of the names of Milwaukee homicide victims. The pastor says he hopes it helps the families who have lost loved ones.
Do you know how they feel? You'll never know. But you can empathize, you can support them, you can support those families.
Lewis says the families have not only lost a relative, but may be trying to cope with depression, unpaid bills, and other problems stemming from the typically sudden deaths of homicide victims. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, looking back at 2016, it might seem like there was only one story, the presidential election. That story did dominate news coverage for months, and the election of Donald Trump has been at the top of the news cycle since November. But that wasn't the only thing that happened in 2016. It was a big news year in Wisconsin, and Rob Menser is with us now to recap some of those big stories. He's a storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, and he's based in Wausau. He's joining us today from our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Judith. Thanks.
So as we mentioned, the presidential election was a huge story in 2016. One of the Wisconsin angles of the story was the evolving relationship between House Speaker and Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan and President-elect Donald Trump. How did that relationship change over the course of the campaign and since?
Sure. Well, this was sort of an ongoing soap opera. It reminds me a bit of the it's like the plot of a romantic comedy. It's like You've Got Mail, where in the beginning the two leads like can't stand each other, and then gradually they do fall in love by the end. And that is sort of Paul Ryan and Donald Trump in 2016. So in the first months of the year, Ryan criticized Trump for violence at rallies. He criticized Trump for not clearly condemning the Ku Klux Klan in a CNN interview in March. So in the lead up to the presidential primary in Wisconsin, Ryan said that he was not ready to support Trump for president. And Trump shot back that he was not ready to support Paul Ryan's agenda as speaker. So there's other twists and turns at the end of the year, as you would always have in a good romantic comedy. But guess what? Trump won the nomination. He won the election. And Trump and Ryan had a couple of meetings. They sort of talked through policy views. And now, you know, post-November 9th, they seem to be hand in glove. And Ryan's excited, looking forward to working with President Trump and sending a bunch of bills for Trump to sign. So it all worked out for political conservatives anyway.
So Wisconsin was the last state to hand Donald Trump a defeat in the primary season. And so clearly he was not the most popular candidate in the state, and that was with the electorate and also many of the political figures. But as you said, Ryan has come around. He's excited about working with Trump. Do you see that as a larger trend playing out in Wisconsin with political officials?
For sure. Wisconsin was kind of the last stand of the never Trump conservatives, right? A lot of conservative intellectuals and commentators were at that time making a case that Donald Trump was unfit to be president and a bad, you know, would make a bad candidate for the Republican Party. But you know, winning elections as a way of papering over those differences in a lot of cases. Many of those voices have sort of fallen away. And to be fair, the elected leaders, including Ryan, were always a little – they were never quite so so out in front on the never Trump stuff as the commentators, conservative intellectuals were. And really when it comes down to it, I mean Paul Ryan's major priority is – tax cuts. That's what I mean. He wants, in particular, to have tax cuts that make the federal tax system less progressive. They are lucrative for top earners, and it turns out that on that issue, Ryan and Trump have no tension whatsoever. They're very much in tune. I think that there might be a number of other issues that they don't see eye to eye on, but on what Paul Ryan sees as his biggest priority, they were very much eye to eye.
We're talking with Rob Menser right now. He's storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, and we're taking a look back at the big news stories of 2016. Now, not only did we elect people in November, it was the first time that we had to present IDs at the polls in order to place those votes. Here in Wisconsin, how did that go?
Well, it's a bit hard to say, right? There are anecdotal reports of people being turned away from the polls. There are somewhat wild inflated claims that have circulated that haven't been checked. Certainly, it affected some number of voters. It's a bit surprising or I don't know. It's hard to think through that the law was passed in 2011, and this is the first major election. There was like a nonpartisan primary a couple years ago, but the first major election where the voter ID law was actually in effect.
And there was a voter ID education campaign that made headlines quite a bit in the last year, and especially leading up to that November election. Do we have any sense of how effective that was?
So one of the things that what happened was very late in September, close to the election, organization Vote Riders that advocates for voting, making voting easier, they released recordings. They had evidence that DMVs all over the state of Wisconsin were illegally withholding state ID cards. They were giving people wrong information about the voter ID law, and so there was a major event right at the end, right in October, where a federal judge ordered a state investigation of how the law was being administ- administered. The state came back and said yes, in fact, that it had gotten a bunch of things wrong. Training was bad in these DMV offices. And then there's this last-minute education drive that you mentioned is what that's how we got that. So, you know, there was a website, there were some broadcast ads intending to promote the truth of the law, which is you can get for free a state ID card if you need one to vote, whether or not you have a driver's license or whatever else. But yeah, I mean, I think that everyone acknowledges that the it's a hard group to reach, right? The people who don't have an ID might also be the people who have trouble reaching the DMV office and so on.
We're looking back at some of the biggest Wisconsin news stories from 2016 with Rob Mentzer of the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. And we're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think was the biggest story in Wisconsin this year? What was the biggest story in your region or your community? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation and take your calls in just a minute. Stay here with us on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our discussion now with Rob Mentzer of the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, about the top Wisconsin news stories of 2016. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What would you nominate as one of the biggest stories of the past year? What made big news in your part of the state? And what did you think of coverage of the news in Wisconsin in the past year? Call in now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Rob, in August, a former Milwaukee police officer shot and killed Sylville Smith in the Sherman Park neighborhood, which set off riots and significant unrest in that area. Tell us about the details of that story.
Sure. So the facts of this incident are complicated. It is not as clear-cut a case as some other high-profile police shootings from around the country have been. Sylville Smith was running away from police. He was armed. He had a gun on him. And we know from there have just been charges released just in the last couple weeks against the former police officer. Smith was trying to throw the gun away. He was trying to throw it over a fence. And as he was doing that, the police officer Dominique Keegan Brown shot Sylville Smith twice and killed him. Now, in that neighborhood, in that Sherman Park neighborhood on Milwaukee's northwest side, this did have the effect. It set off a powder keg. There were protests, and there was out and out rioting and fires and that followed real unrest. Ultimately, what came of it? You noted that Keegan Brown is a former police officer. Mm-hmm. He was just charged this month with a homicide charge in this incident. He also was charged a couple months later after the shooting of sexual assault and prostitution in an incident where prosecutors say he raped an intoxicated man the day after the shooting and bragged that he could do whatever he wanted without repercussions. Both of those cases will be adjudicated in court. That remains to be seen. In a sort of perhaps more hopeful news out of this story, it has spurred some attempts to aid the community economically. There are new pushes for economic development in the Sherman Park neighborhood, and Milwaukee received a federal grant for I think it was $5 million to go to boost existing neighborhood programs that are aimed at helping young people in that neighborhood.
And actually, coming up on Tuesday, we'll be talking with someone from the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council about calls for release of the police body cam video from that case. So still more to look into. Rob, another big story this year, for the first time since 1972, UW-Madison is not in the nation's top five research universities, according to the National Science Foundation. What led to that?
Well, so I found this is in a way a bit of a more subtle story than some of the other big headline dominating stories that we have been talking about. But it could signal the fruit of some long-term trends in Wisconsin. Obviously, the UW system as a whole has seen steady erosion of state support. That's going back, I mean, that's over the course of decades. Most recently, in the 2015 state budget, Governor Scott Walker and lawmakers cut $250 million from the system's overall budget. So it makes sense that there would be effects from this, and it's possible that this is 1 year, this is more of a fluke. So to be explicit about it, University of Wisconsin-Madison fell from being ranked number four to being ranked number six. It's not as if it fell to 28 or something, but it's seen as, and it was characterized as, potentially a canary in the coal mine, or potentially the start of a troubling trend that could ultimately reduce the clout and the prestige of that institution.
And Governor Walker will be making his budget address soon. He'll be submitting a budget. There will be budget discussions with the legislature. Does information like this perhaps influence what they decide to do with requests from UW-Madison for funding?
I think that if I'm not mistaken, I think legislators are looking to have said that they're looking to add some amount of funding to UW system. Now who knows, right? And it's a long budget process, and there's going to be a bunch of fights about that. But I do think that to some extent, you know, the UW system has been a whipping boy among some legislators. It's unquestionably the case. And but I think at the same time, there's a state pride and a sense that the institution contributes economically. Economically to the state, which is demonstrable. So, you know, we'll see, right? We'll see how it plays out. The people are pretty dug in on their partisan sides, but I don't imagine that there's a lot of lawmakers who like the prospect that UW-Madison loses prestige.
So, Rob, one big story in northern and western Wisconsin in particular this year was flooding. In August, there was nearly a foot of rain in western Wisconsin, hitting Trempealeau and Buffalo counties especially hard. How much damage was there after that really pretty dramatic weather event?
So there were a few instances of serious flooding with major damages in the Northwoods or in western Wisconsin. I think that one was FEMA estimated that there were $30 million in damages when you count damage to homes, businesses, and infrastructure. In September, there were floods across the Northwoods. From Ashland over to Ironwood, and that was estimated at another $20 million. Wisconsin did apply for and did get federal funds to assist in rebuilding, but, you know, I mean, these things don't happen overnight, and for sure, these are both events that will have effects, long in the future.
We've all been tracking closely and for quite a while the crisis at some of the veterans facilities in Wisconsin, and this year especially the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King came under fire. What are the charges of what's been going on there?
So King Veterans Home is a state-run nursing home for veterans. It's located sort of halfway between Stevens Point and Appleton. And in late August, the Capital Times published a big story looking at conditions that included allegations that it was hugely understaffed, poorly managed, lacked resources to help residents. There were some images showing, sort of gross water in tubs and signs that raise questions about sanitary conditions. And it certainly got the attention of lawmakers. There have been investigations launched. In November, Governor Scott Walker announced that the head of the State Department of Veterans Affairs would step down. But there was another, I mean, there was a story that came out this week. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported that there was evidence found. The federal government found evidence of a cover up of a particular safety violation at the home. So I think that to some extent the investigations are still going to be ongoing, and we don't know what all the fallout will be.
Well, and I believe just today there was actually in that state audit, it came out that a claim that a whistleblower had made was in fact true. So this is certainly ongoing. And this is also on the heels of all the issues that were at the Toma VA hospital as well. It seems like there's really a systematic problem with managing these veterans' facilities.
Yes, it does seem like it's some of the allegations are familiar. One of the most striking things to me, especially in the original report, was that the King Veterans Home in recent years had been running a surplus.
Right.
They had gotten between $30 million and $40 million in its last two-year budget cycle in federal Medicaid payments, more than what they were spending on actual patient care or facilities. So they would transfer out, maybe it was, it was up to $12 million this year back to Madison to pay for administrator salaries or other, you know, sort of administrative department expenses that don't have any direct effect on the veterans at King Veterans Home. This seems like something is that can't be right.
Finally, one of the most recognizable musical groups from Wisconsin released their first album in 5 years, Bon Iver. What do you think of it, Rob? It's called 22 a Million.
I like it. It's weird, but you know what? I'm down. I'm interested in it. Yeah, Justin Vernon, they love him in Eau Claire. But yeah, 22 a Million came out at the end of September. Vernon had a big press conference there in Eau Claire, and just recently we found out that album was nominated for a Grammy. So good for that guy. That's a point of Wisconsin pride. I think that his connection to his hometown. He's behind a big summer music festival
right.
there.
He's Eau Claire's,
behind a
right.
yeah behind a big downtown hotel development there. And so you know, every five years we get a pretty cool album from that guy.
Well, Rob, thanks so much for being with us today and for coming on with us. I think pretty much every Friday through the last year. And Happy New Year.
Hey, thanks. You too.
That was Robert Menser. He's storytelling editor with USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joined us to look back at the top Wisconsin news stories of 2016. And if you have an idea of one of the top stories that we didn't get to today, post it over on the Central Time Facebook page. We'd love to see what caught your interest. Coming up, we get the story of some of the most useful inventions that benefit us every day, but that we don't really think much about where they came from. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Author and historian Kevin Baker thinks that America is a pretty creative place, especially for a young country. He shares a lot of fascinating examples in his new book, America the Ingenious: How a Nation of Dreamers, Immigrants, and Tinkerers Changed the World. Kevin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So you say in your book that America is an unusually inventive nation, and you list several factors you think makes that the case. One is a very broad one. It's freedom. And what do you mean by that?
I mean the ability of people in America to both go out on their own and try to come up and with anything they can and invent it, and also the ability to get their voices heard about really good ideas. Jesse Hawley, for instance, was an upstate New York flower merchant with really a Little Red Schoolhouse education, but who ended up in debtor's prison in Geneva, New York, because he could not get his goods to market in time. He came up with the idea of the Erie Canal that revolutionized where America's place in the world. People like that, and also people such as A.P. Giannini, the investment banker in San Francisco, who started the Bank of America and who really helped put through the Golden Gate Bridge, along with many other great additions to the Bay Area's infrastructure, or William Ogden, who basically saw the opportunity that Chicago's location provided and built that that town almost by himself in the beginning.
And you also say, and this might be surprising to some people, that government involvement is crucial.
Government is absolutely crucial. Government has played many key roles in American invention, and it does that through a number of things. For one, one way is that it arbitrates. Government patent rules and government court rulings have been absolutely crucial in ending what would have been otherwise endless fights over just who invented the cotton gin, the sewing machine, the telephone, the telegraph, the phonograph, the television. These fights would have gone on and on. Government made the decisions about who deserved what credit. They saved terrific grassroots American inventors such as Philo Farnsworth, who invented electronic TV, from having his invention stolen by David Sarnoff and RCA. Raymond Damadian, who came up with the MRI, they saved GE from simply stealing that from him. Government also regulates in terms of doing things like antitrust, which has been a tremendous spur to invention. AT&T, William Shockley's team at AT&T came up with the transistor. The government stepped in and said, AT&T, you can't have both this incredible new invention and the national phone company. So they spun this off. Shockley took his new invention to California, where he had grown up, and started something that became known as Silicon Valley. So, you know, in this way, government can really spur innovation. Government outright subsidizes things. Hmm. Almost every foot of railroad in this country, including the Transcontinental Railroad, the Transatlantic Cable, the First Telegraph, the Hoover Dam, the Erie Canal, the electronics industry, whole cities such as Los Angeles and Chicago are based on a lot of government subsidies. They set a framework for invention through both things like the TVA, which really provided power to a whole region of the country and transformed life there, and through things like public education. And finally, government picks winners. You have Abraham Lincoln testing the Spencer repeating rifle out on the Washington Mall. Apparently, he was a very good shot. Hmm. And he decided against the advice of his of some of his generals, who didn't like this because they felt it led soldiers to fire too fast. You know, you don't want soldiers firing too rapidly in a battle. Lincoln tests this out himself. He says, go with it. It becomes a major factor at the end of the war. Governments will pick winners, whether we like it or not. The question is picking winners as opposed to losers.
Well, let's focus in on some of the inventions that we don't think about much, but that have impacted our everyday lives in really significant ways. I'd like to start with the Otis safety elevator, because that story really brings in not only invention and inventiveness, but a real flair for showmanship.
Yeah, Otis was quite an amazing figure. He was sort of this Job-like figure. He was a tremendously brilliant, inventive man, came out of this New England farm culture, and just went through all the trials of Job. You know, his wife dies, leaving him with these two young sons. He's trying to support them. He invents things and starts mills, and they fail for reasons that are often not his fault. You know, somebody diverts the water supply or something else goes wrong, and he's about to throw it all up and just head west and go look for gold or something he can sell the gold miners, when he hits upon the idea for the safety elevator, which is basically a sort of wagon brake that he adapted and put on an elevator. And this transformed the whole idea of elevators. You had elevators for a long time, but making them safe was something else. And he demonstrated this with the help of P.T. Barnum at the Crystal Palace, which was a sort of early World's Fair in New York, imitated the one in London. And they would put on a regular demonstration. He'd get up there in a top hat, Elijah Otis, and he'd have a big saber or sometimes an axe, and he would have himself hoisted up into the air several stories, and it would be announced that the ladies should get out their smelling salts, because who knew what was going to happen then. And he would take this big sword or axe and slash the rope holding the elevator, and you know, everybody would scream in horror, and the elevator would drop a few feet and stop as his safety brake caught on it, and he would cry out, "All safe, ladies and gentlemen, all safe." And from that, he built an amazing global company, Otis Elevators, and really helped transform our life in ways we don't always expect. This really made possible the skyscraper, which really changed life in the urban U.S.
We're talking with Kevin Baker about his most recent book, which is titled America the Ingenious, How a Nation of Dreamers, Immigrants, and Tinkerers Changed the World. Well, I want to move from the safety elevator to the safety pin, and the inventor of the safety pin was one of those pretty eccentric characters that seem to crop up when you're talking about inventors, Walter Hunt. Who was he?
Walter Hunt was a wonderfully eccentric individual. He was somebody who came from upstate New York to the big city, and all along the way invented one marvelous thing after another, usually well ahead of its time. We're talking about everything from a great repeating rifle to a really good sewing machine to the little wheels on your luggage, the little caster globes, to devices for walking on the ceiling used by circuses that lasted for something like 100 years after his death.
Wow.
Were still in use. Tremendous inventor. And what he specialized in was inventing these things and essentially giving them all away. Yeah, he would invent something, and he would either sell the patent for next to nothing, or at one point he invented this great sewing machine, and his daughter convinced him it would put all these seamstresses out of work. The exact opposite was actually true. It would be a great way of providing employment for many women, but because she objected to it, he never pursued the patent. And what he really looked to make money from was more his dreadful paintings. You know, he painted a lot of paintings of ponies and puppies and things like that, and real estate investments in New York, which he didn't really have the head for. So he'd always end up back in his shop in Abingdon Square down in Greenwich Village trying to invent something else. And at one point he owed all of $15 to somebody who was not pressing him to pay the debt at all. But he was worrying over this, and he went to visit this guy and tell him how sorry he was, and he's fiddling with a bit of wire as he's doing this. And from that, he has this eureka moment, and he goes home and invents the first effective safety pin ever. People have been using pins from back in the Neolithic age. You know, they find them next to the mammoth bones. But here he was. He had finally found a way to make this work. And he does this, and he says, great. And he goes out and sells this to an entrepreneur for $400 on the caveat, with the caveat that he himself pursue getting the patent for this.
Wow.
And he's very happy because he can now settle this $15 debt.
We're talking right now with Kevin Baker, author of America the Ingenious. We're learning about lots of inventions that have improved our lives significantly, but that we may not give much thought to. And we'll continue the conversation here on Central Time after a short break. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now with historian and author Kevin Baker about his book, America the Ingenious. So it seems like a lot of ingenuity was inspired by the need and desire to make domestic work less of a burden on women, and sometimes women were the ones that came up with the solution. Can you tell us about Josephine Garris Cochran and her dishwasher?
Yes, Josephine Garris Cochran came up with the first dishwasher that really depended on water pressure to clean the dishes instead of scrubbers, which caused a lot less dish breaking. And she really had to sell this invention on her own for years, and she kept being frustrated by the people she would hire to build working models. She said, I couldn't get men to do the things I wanted in my way until they had tried and failed in their own. And that was costly for me. I knew nothing academically about mechanics, and they insisted on having their own way with my invention until they convinced themselves my way was the better. This is so much like men. But she eventually triumphed and won out with her dishwasher. And there were a lot of things women were inventing around the home. You know, there was Catherine Beecher of the remarkable Beecher family, who was the big sort of prophetess of home economics in the 19th century. And she felt women's role really was at the home, but she also felt that was the most important role in society to have. And women needed to really become experts in everything from how to build a house to how to run it, how to take care of farm animals, how to raise kids. And this was reflected in a lot of the invention that went on. So you have women who were, to a great degree, banned from the workplace, of course, and to a great degree not allowed to patent things or had their patents stolen, but inventing all sorts of things on the basis of inventing all sorts of things that were invaluable around the house. For instance, Marion O'Brien Donovan, who comes up with the diaper cover that's tremendously successful. She also came up with the first idea for the disposable diaper, although, you know, men laughed at her, you know, who would need disposable diapers? Well, somebody who's changing all those diapers knows that that those are needed. So and then as women, of course, moved into the workplace, they were able to do very and have done very well there too. Everything from the Kevlar vest of Stephanie Louise Kwalik to software engineering on Apollo 11 that was provided by Margaret Heafield Hamilton, who also invented the term software engineering. So the minute women were given a chance, they produced tremendous things in every realm. But when they were restricted to the realm of the household, they were very productive there.
Well, and you say in your book that both women and people of color were very inventive, but one did not have often access to that formal traditional education and then were not allowed to patent their ideas. And often those ideas were taken by white men. Have we seen a large change in how women and people of color are able to get credit for their work?
Yes, we have. We've seen, for instance, women had held something like 1% of all patents about 100 years ago. Today they hold 7%, which of course is a 700-fold increase.
Still small,
a seven-fold increase, 700% increase, and that's a tremendous thing. It still is not close to what you'd want to see. But it's a tremendous increase once they were allowed to do things, and they were not allowed for many years even to patent things. The oldest invention we have in the book is a sort of corn mill that was invented by Dame Sybilla Masters in 1715, even older than the country. But she was not allowed to get the patent in her own name. She had to do it through her husband. Similarly, Thomas Jennings came up with an early dry cleaning process and got the first patent that we know a black man had in this country. It was a huge outcry at the time because people were saying, all these whites were saying, well, you know, a slave can't have a patent. Of course, he was not a slave. He had been free his entire life, and he used the money he made from this to buy his wife and daughter out of slavery. And his daughter, Elizabeth Jennings, was sort of the Rosa Parks of the North in the 19th century and became this educator, and she was forced off a streetcar for being a black person. She took this to court and won and got the streetcars of New York integrated. So there is a tremendous connection between what people are able to do and bringing this to some greater social good. Another wonderful person we have in there is Madame Demarest, this young woman named Nell Curtis, who came to New York and got married with her husband, started the first real dress pattern business going out all over the country. They also used their magazines selling these dress patterns to be an advocate for women's rights, for the rights of people of color. It was an advocate for abolition against slavery, and they actually had the first real business of that size that was completely integrated and treated their black employees as well as their white employees. So these are steps forward for all of us a lot of the time.
And as we wrap up, Kevin, how would you assess our current time in terms of invention and innovation?
I think it's a tremendous time, and it doesn't always seem like that because there aren't always things as dramatic as, say, the car or the telephone coming out. But I think you'll see the results of things we're not even really that aware of sneaking up on us. The self-driving car will change a tremendous number of things. Nanotechnology, which will give us the space elevator eventually and transform many of the ways in which we live. Gene therapy, prosthetics, replacing parts of the body. These will all transform the way we live. You know, it's a terrific future ahead of us if we continue to know how to promote invention and to use it wisely.
Kevin, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
That was historian and author Kevin Baker. We spoke with him about his new book, America the Ingenious, How a Nation of Dreamers, Immigrants, and Tinkerers Changed the World. Wisconsin has also given the world some important inventions. Here's Wisconsin Life executive producer Erica Janik.
The Babcock Butterfat Tester transformed the dairy industry and helped Wisconsin become the dairy state. It's a big story for such a humble object. Wisconsin Historical Museum curator Dave Driscoll shares the story of this transformative invention.
Hasp unhooking. This is a Babcock tester, but it's a very unusual Babcock tester. If you look at it from across the room, it looks like a regular old cheese box. And the way it works is the farmer puts the milk with its proper dilution and additives into the flasks, puts the flasks into the tester, closes the lid, and cranks the handle on the side, which causes the flask to spin around and the butterfat to collect in the necks of the bottles. There are lots of different kinds of Babcock testers that were produced. Most of them are made out of metal. So this is a pretty unprofessional version because it could well be homemade. And the reason for that, I think, has to do with Babcock's approach to the test. In the 1880s, one of the biggest issues facing the dairy industry was how to improve quality. And if you were a creamery, a cheese factory, or a butter maker, it was hard for you to tell which farmers were giving you the best milk. So the question is how to assess the quality of milk. And there were a number of people in Wisconsin working on that. Frederick Short was an agricultural chemist at the University of Wisconsin Agricultural Experiment Station. And one of the many tasks he performed there was to try and determine an effective butterfat test. So Short came up with the idea that if you use some kind of a chemical solvent in a milk sample that would separate the butterfat from the rest of the milk, and then you centrifuged it to concentrate the butterfat, that would be a more expeditious way to do it. He published this in an article, but left before he got a chance to turn it into a workable test. And that task fell to Stephen Babcock, who got most of the credit and got his name on the final test. This was such a significant test that Babcock and the rest of the faculty at the UW decided that it should be shared with everyone. So Babcock declined to patent it. He felt that this was really created for the benefit of the entire industry and that everyone would benefit if this was absolutely freely available. I like this object for two reasons. One is it is so kind of homemade, which I think does connect to that share it with the people idea. I mean, it's kind of an embodiment of the Wisconsin idea in a way. The other thing I like about it is that, in general, the Babcock test story is pretty well known. But this is a very unusual, odd-looking one. This is not your standard Babcock tester. So it kind of tells a different part of the story.
That story is part of Wisconsin 101, a collaborative project to explore our history in objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Thanks for listening to us in 2016, and we look forward to sharing 2017 with you as well. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.